Well, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Well, seeing the children with us this morning makes me think about how children learn. And children learn to tell the truth by experience, don't you think? Every child experiments now and then with fibbing or being deceitful. What can I get away with here? Now, I remember when I tried this as a young boy, I was warned that if I did not tell the truth, it would become increasingly difficult for me to keep my story straight. And I think most children learn eventually that lying is not going to be a very sustainable strategy for getting through life. But I think what converts most young children is that little voice of conscience in their heads. At least it was that voice of conscience in my head that converted me to trying to be, more often than not, a truth teller. You see, they notice that what they're saying on the outside is not consistent with what they're holding on the inside. And that is an intolerable situation for a child. You can see it in their bodies. Well, the truth just wants to come out. Unfortunately, as we get older, we build this kind of unholy resilience within ourselves that enables us to carry falsehoods longer. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove recalls a notorious decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court in his recent book, Reconstructing the Gospel. He explains that Justice Thomas Ruffin was an Episcopalian who had given the land for St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Hillsboro. You know the church I'm talking about if you've ever been to Hillsboro. It is that beautiful Anglican church on the hillside, right outside of town, and it has these beautiful gardens and big old trees and this magnificent cemetery. It's that church. Become a tourist. Go to Hillsboro. You'll see. Justice Ruffin heard a case involving a white man who had been convicted of assault against a black woman. And writing an opinion for the higher court in this case that became known as State versus John Mann, Justice Ruffin seemed to go out of his way to recognize the humanity of the woman in the case who was an enslaved person. Ruffin's opinion was unusual in these days for his strenuous effort to recognize the personhood and humanity of all people involved. But the justice wrote in conclusion that the legal precedents were nevertheless very clear, and he held that slaveholders were justified in abusing the people that they owned, because the power of the slaveholder needed to be absolute in order to sustain the current system. Now, Justice Ruffin was a faithful Episcopalian. He had given portions of his estate to the establishment of one of the oldest churches in North Carolina. A priest who served St. Matthew's Church later wondered how such a faithful Episcopalian could take communion every Sunday at the altar rail and still render such an unequal and inhumane decision. Was his life not at all shaped by the reading of the gospel? For the Eucharist proclaimed to Justice Ruffin that that he could see the face of Christ in all of his neighbors. And yet he told himself a different story. See, slavery was a profound falsehood. It was the untruthful assertion that some human beings are not made in the image of God. Brooks Grabner was the longtime rector of St. Matthew's Parish in Hillsborough. He retired just last year after 27 years of ministry there. If you Google his name, you can hear him offering these beautiful reflections on the history of North Carolina and what it means to be a person of faith in this place. Reverend Grabner said, "Reading Justice Ruffin's decision today is like watching a man tear himself in two." So there's a turning point in the narrative of King David that we have been reading all summer. And it came in our schedule about 2 weeks ago when his world begins to fall apart after his assault on Bathsheba. David's behavior has far-reaching consequences for himself and for others, for the entire nation of Israel. And from here, most things in David's life, let's just not be coy about it. You know, they go horribly wrong. Earlier in the narrative, David's problems were all external. Think back to the beginning of the summer. David was fighting the Philistines. He was fighting the Amalekites. He was fighting everybody outside of Israel. But now, David's problems are all internal. He's in conflict with himself, like a child whose conscience keeps telling her that something is not right, like a slaveholder who reads the gospel. David is tearing himself in two. Today's passage is the climactic moment in David's inner war. His son Absalom suffers a dramatic death in battle against his father. From here on out, for David, it's a pretty sad and stumbling march to the finish. He won't accomplish anything of great significance by the end of the book. The whole nation languishes until his son Solomon eventually takes the throne. Well, this story has been on my mind because, you know, we've been reading it all summer. But these reflections of racial justice have also been on my mind because that's been part of the journey of our church this summer, too. Last weekend, 46 pilgrims from United Church of Chapel Hill traveled to Montgomery, Alabama, to visit the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which recovers the stories of all those lives lost to racial violence since the end of the Civil War. The Equal Justice Initiative has documented more than 4,400 racial terror lynchings between 1870 and 1920. And our pilgrims did their own research to learn about those stories in Orange County and the surrounding counties. And so as we traveled, we carried these stories in our hearts, and we held the names of these people whose stories were not told in prayer. On Friday evening, a few of us walked from our hotel to the state capital of Montgomery, which is just a few blocks away. And we found large buildings set in white stone. Maybe you're familiar if you've ever been to the capital of Alabama. Many had Corinthian columns, and they were all sort of pointing to the ideals of a great society, like the ancient Greeks. But you know, it was a house of cards set in the sinking sands of white supremacy. And the Capitol is still surrounded by sentimental monuments to the Confederacy, including a ghastly statue of Jefferson Davis. He looks like Dracula, someone said. The most telling symbol, I thought, was a seal that's still set in the Capitol steps. If you look hard, you can find it. There's a seal that that has an emblem in the center. And, I mean, this thing is life size. It's like the size of this pulpit here. And then around the edges of the seal are the names of all these great nations. France, Great Britain, the United States of America. And then in one corner of the seal is the Confederate States of America. So the seal is saying, you know, we are a great society like all these other societies. And one of these days we'll be recognized as such. It's an emblem of the aspirations of the Confederacy. But before visiting Montgomery, I could not really understand the city spatially. Because if you're standing there next to that seal, and you turn and you look down the main boulevard or avenue, well, what you see is you're sort of surrounded by these great big white buildings. But less than a block away is this brick church. It's deep red, and it's the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. That's where Dr. King organized the bus boycotts. And before going to Montgomery, I could not understand just how close he was to the heart of power. He was standing in the shadows of power, not more than 100 yards away from this great seal that had been set in stone. The deep red brick of this historic church stands out still today as a prophetic statement against the surrounding vanities of whiteness. I don't understand how you could argue with these massive white edifices. They seem to me to make a pretty clear statement about who has power, whose voices are valued, and how the social structures will be arranged. Well, we met on Saturday afternoon with staff from the Equal Justice Initiative, including their legal director, Randy Suskin. Some of you this summer may have joined us in reading Just Mercy, which is the book by the founder of EJI, Brian Stevenson. If Brian Stevenson has a book in him, let me tell you, this guy, Randy Suskin, has got at least one book in him. I could have listened to him talk all day. He's represented clients in Alabama since the late 1980s, and he framed the work of building a memorial as an exercise in telling the truth, in coming clean, in being honest about our history. He said it was so dispiriting to walk for decades into Southern courtrooms, passing by memorials to the Confederacy, and by portraits of white judges to represent poor African Americans who could never see themselves in these gilded frames of power. It's no accident, Suskin said, that those celebrated and memorialized look nothing like my clients. He said, we can't accept that the present social arrangements are the only way that our world could be ordered. He railed against the passive acceptance of the present order. And he rejected the complacency and the fatalism that says, oh, that's just the way things are. We have to accept the world as it is. He said that he didn't think this analogy was unfair. He said it's not unlike going to Germany. If you can imagine that going to court, you had to walk past portraits of Nazi party officers. How could any American, seeing such statuary in Germany, say or conclude that, well, that statuary has nothing to do with ideology or power? That's just history and heritage. Well, of course not. So likewise, could you imagine a German coming to the American South, and you go down to Chatham County, and you park on the courthouse square, and as you try to find your courtroom, you walk past a 25-foot-tall statue of a Confederate soldier? I mean, can you imagine that a German seeing that would say, oh, that has nothing to do with issues of racial justice. It's just a historical marker. Well, preposterous, Randy Susskind said. So the creation of these memorials is about having a more honest relationship with the past, telling the fuller story, so that what we know deep within is reconciled with what we express outwardly. That was our hope when we gathered for worship in a hotel ballroom on Saturday night. After visiting the memorial, we wanted to express what was deep and true and what needed to be said. And every member of our group came forward and took a stone and placed it on the communion table as a symbol of making confession. Confession for the stories that we have ignored, or for the assumptions that we've made about other people. Confession for the silence that we have tolerated for too long. Confession for the ways in which we participate in systems that hold on to this falsehood that some people bear the image of God more than others. That, I think, was one of the most powerful parts of our experience. I think that making of confession, because it does little good to sort of wag your finger at others and try to persuade them to reconcile or examine their own racial presuppositions. The work that we all have to do is inner work. It's the work of making to match what's on the inside with what's on the outside. So, you know, falsehoods, they might be hidden from your parents for a little while. Maybe you could even convince a whole society of something that's not true. But we've been reading all about King David, who is the story of what happens when you try to hide your inner life from God. Or consider what it meant to Justice Ruffin to cleave himself in two as he parsed the letter of the law. The God who promises fullness of life demands of us wholeness of truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus says. No one gets to heaven except through me. Some Christians take that to mean that you have to be Christian to get into heaven. I think that's wrong. I think that's a terrible misinterpretation of the text. I am the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus says. I think Jesus means that holding on to a lie will keep you forever stuck in hell. Straight is the way and narrow the gate, Jesus says. Which means you can try another path if you want to, but there's really only one way to get there from here. The only path is the path of truth. The only path is the path that is lit by the light of truth. So we've been going through these exercises as a whole congregation because we feel called to embrace the truth. I believe that it would be so liberating, not just to us, but to our whole community, to our whole state and region, if we joined and participated in the recovery of the truth. Let us be people who embrace the truth. Let us be people who share the truth with others. Amen.